the program is a continuation on a discussion of the steps, of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope most of you, or all of you really, had the benefit of Doug Talbot and his group in discussing the first three, and then we had Elmer Ratzlaff and the next series of steps. And that leaves for this morning's discussion steps 9, 10, 11, and 12 to complete the 12 steps of the program. My name is Conway Hunter, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a grateful alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be alive, and I'm grateful to be sober. And I'm grateful to be here and to be with you people and in this meeting. It's been my privilege to come to quite a few meetings of IDAA now, and I really regret the ones that I missed that were along the way. And I certainly do intend to continue this relationship with my peers, because you see, this is something that I think that we all need. This is the spirit of the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the thing that bonds us all together. This is the thing that unifies us. The spirit of love. The spirit of fellowship. Have you ever heard a place anywhere and people talking about a progressive terminal fatal illness and all you hear is laughter? All you hear is laughter. You hear the laughter because we're the survivors. We're the winners. Each and every one of us is a miracle. Each and every one of us is a hero. We are the chosen ones. And to help me this morning with the discussion of steps 9, 10, 11, and 12 are some very dear people to me, and some that I know that you will enjoy. And first of all, for step 9, which is AAS, oops, I'm into the traditions. Step 9, may direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Is Stan M. from Memphis, Tennessee. Please welcome Stan.
I am Stan Myers, and I am recovering from the disease of alcoholism. A very good man came to the end of his life's journey. He found himself standing in front of the pearly gates and met St. Peter. And St. Peter welcomed him and checked the list, and sure enough, he was on the list. And St. Peter asked him what religious affiliation he'd had on earth, and he said he had none. And St. Peter told him not to worry, but come on in, and he was going to show him around and so that he could fit in with the groups that were there and feel comfortable. He took him down this long hall and opened the first room, and there was these people in there on their knees praying, counting beads, and saying Hail Mary. He shut the door and he said, that's our Catholic brother. He walked down the hall, opened the next door, and there were people in there with their hands over their head shouting Hallelujah and praise the Lord. He shut the door and he said, that's our Jehovah Witnesses brothers. He walked to the next room, opened the door, and there was these people in there fellowshipping and eating around the table. And he said, as he shut the door, she said, that's our Methodist brother. He went to the next door, and there were people in there in this smoke-filled room talking loudly and drinking coffee. And he shut the door, and they walked down the hall, and the guy turned to St. Peter. He said, what about those people? He said, oh, don't pay any attention to those fools. All we can get out of them is they're just up here one day at a time. I did that for me. I grew up in an alcoholic home. And learn not to trust, not to feel, not to love, and not to share. I got through medical school and went into general practice at the age of 25 and found myself in a situation that was well above my head. I began to get problems with sleep and not being able to cope with my situation. And one of the promises that I made myself when my father died when I was age 14 is that I'd never be like him. But I can recall the night that I reached into my bag to get some relief. And I found that relief. And for the next 5 years, I had some sort of chemical altering the way I felt. I lost a practice, a general practice, came back and was a drunk internal medicine resident. And they gave me 2 hospitalizations, each 30 days with psychiatric care. This was back in the mid-60s. The last one, I should have got the message when the last one, when they put me in the last room on the GYN floor for 30 days. Finally, they called me in and told me that if I did not straighten up, that I would never practice medicine. They'd see to it. And I had worked hard to get where I was. So I straightened up. And for the next 7 years, I was able to stay sober. I went to Vietnam, came back, and even came back and finished my 3rd year of medicine as the chief resident of medicine, and went to Duke and did my allergy there. Came back, passed my boards in internal medicine and allergy, and then, for some reason, in 1973, decided that, I'd try that again. And I think it was a combination of being bored and having some pressures again coming in on me that I did not know how to cope with. And I said, it'll be different this time. And for the next 7 years, I went to the point that I made a suicide attempt. And I say that because when I came into this program, I made several attempts and went through treatment 3 times. But one of the things that kept me, I think, drunk was the fact that I knew I had done it before on my own, and why couldn't I do it again? And I went to a lot of AA meetings at first under the influence and saw counselors and psychiatrists, always looking for something magic to happen to me. I grew up in the Baptist church, and the message that I got from them was that if I just turn it all over, and I also got that message from my mother, that if I just turn it over, everything would be wonderful. And I kept turning it over, and things were not wonderful because I kept trying to change from bad to good and instead of from sick to well. This program has done a lot for me. I want to share a little with you about the Step 9 and making amends and how I did that. One of the things that happened to me, I think that, you know, when we're saying a general way, you know, what we were like, what happened to us, and what we're like now, I think the turning point or my moment of truth came after the 3rd hospitalization, and I left treatment and went back to using some stuff and came back to the fellow that was in charge of the treatment facility in which I went through. And we talked, and he said to me, "Stan, you've not had much luck in getting sober, have you?" And I said, "No, I haven't." He said, "Would you like to be sober?" And I really did. All those times I wanted to be sober. I said, "I really do, Bill." He said, "I think you can if you're willing to do one thing." I said, "What is it?" "I'm willing to do it." He said, "I believe if you'll do everything that I tell you to do, you'll make it." And from that day to this, I've tried to do that. And I think I've made a discovery that the secret to working the spiritual program of AA is not knowledge and wisdom and understanding, but it's obedience. And for today, with me just doing what I'm told to do, it seems to work out. If I try to figure out how it works and why it works and if it's going to work, like Roger said, all that stuff gets going around in my head and it makes me very confused. I've been through the steps twice, the first time on my own and the second time with the help of a fellow that led me through the steps. The first time I worked the steps. The second time I experienced the steps in my life. And I'd like to share with you today some of the results of something that happened to me as a result of that experience. Because it's, to me today, it's being able to do these things and to experience within my own self benefits to me of doing what I'm told to do. One of the things that happened to me when I went through the steps the first time, I had borrowed a car from a fellow that owned a friend of mine that owned a car dealership because I wanted to see, I was in need of a car and wanted to purchase it, and I was drunk that night and I wrecked it. Well, I took the car back, never said anything to him. I made arrangements for the insurance to take care of it, but I never followed up on it, never even made any contact with him. And when we went through this, I felt the need to go to this fellow and see if I needed to make any kind of restitution. Well, I had gone to church with this fellow. It was very difficult, and I put it off a long time. But I had a car wreck, and the insurance company sent me to his dealership to rent a car from them. I went there and slipped in, got the car, and slipped out. When I took the car back, I was going to slip in and slip out again, and I walked in, and there he stood in the middle of the showroom, and so I just kind of waved at him and slipped on into the leasing office. When I got in there, I got very busy in there, and felt like the walls were closing in on me, so I went out the door and ran into him, and I had to talk to him, and so I went to his office, and I explained to him that what had happened, and I had been drunk, and I wanted to make restitution if necessary, and explained to him that I was in AA, and I was needing to make amends to him about this. And in our conversation, he said to me, he said, "Stan, how in the world did you let this happen to you?" And I left that office that day with that in my mind. And I went home and I didn't sleep well that night thinking, how did I let this happen to me? You know, I was not going to be like my father. I was not going to be a drunk. And I couldn't sleep well. I got that night, and the next morning I got up and I was sitting in the den. And all of a sudden it came to me that I did not let this happen to me, that this is a disease and I am not responsible for having the disease. I did take the chemicals that initiated it, but I'm not responsible. But what happened as a result of that, it gave me a new emphasis, but I am 100% responsible for my recovery. And I was able to get out of the problem that existed with me then, worrying about how I'd let that happen to me and why and so forth, and get into the solution, and which was recovery and being responsible for my own recovery. I never thought I had much feelings for my father. I thought he never bothered me. He abused my brother, but he never bothered me. And one of the things that I was able to do not too long ago was to go to his grave. He died when I was 14, and I sort of became head of the household and never gave him much thought. And that's been almost 35 years ago now. And so I was able to go to his grave and stand over his grave and to forgive him for having the same disease I have. And that I was able to stand there and cry for the first time about that and cry about him. And was also be able to stand. My wife went with me, and that was a great experience, that we stood there and shared and talked to him as if he were alive and told him about what had happened to me and about what I was doing now and about our children. And that was a great experience. To be able to, you know, for me, it was almost unbelievable the amount of feelings I had about a lot of things in my life that I never allowed myself to experience. And this program has given me a way to share these experiences and to people that I feel like that do not judge me. I felt like all my life people were judging me. And even as I came up when I was expressed feelings to my mother of a negative sort type things and concerns, she'd say, "Stan, you know you don't feel like that." And I got programmed not to feel and not to talk about my feelings. When I was a drunk resident, they gave me 2 hospitalizations, and as I was going through the steps, the fifth step with my sponsor the first time, we talked about what had happened and in that residency and so forth, and when we finished, he says, "I think maybe that you need to make some reverse amends." And I said, "What? What is a reverse amend?" He says, "I think you need to go to your director, your training program, and thank him for not canning you and for putting up with what he did, and should tell him what's happened to you, and because he knew about the first part of my addiction, but he did not know about the second part of my addiction." So I went, and I sat down with Jeff and talked to him. This is a man I looked up to and idolized, and he was a very kind, concerned, caring man. And I finished telling him about the first episode a little bit, and then what had happened to me in the meantime, and then going back into my addiction and my treatment and everything, and then I was in AA and so forth. When we finished, I finished telling him, he looked at me and he says, "I'm an alcoholic, and I've gone to 3 AA meetings." He said, "But I can't stop drinking." And as a result of that, over the next, and talked and talked, and I explained to him about treatment and how treatment worked and so forth, and was able to encourage him and get him into treatment. And he's gone through treatment, taken him a couple of times too, but now he's sober. And that, you know, the funny thing that happened when I left there that day, I'm saying to myself, you know, he's not an alcoholic. He can't be an alcoholic. it was really a strange feeling. But, you know, those things happen. But that's been a great experience. And going through the steps a second time, and the way that that happened was I began to go to a new meeting downtown in Memphis, and there was a fellow down there that was carrying people through the steps, and was able to, over a three-month period, meeting once a week, to go through the various steps and to work them and to do them. And I really feel like, for the first time, really experience them. The thing he told me to do when I got my new list of amends to make, and we went over the old ones and then got some new ones, and one of the things that I had not done very well, or had not done really at all, was with my family. I had not really gone to them one-on-one, each individual, and told them how I felt. The thing that he told me to do to the people that I needed to make amends to was to go to them and tell them that I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, and that I am working the AA program, I am in AA, and I'm working the steps, and I'm on the ninth step, and that it says that I should make amends to people that I feel like that I had harmed, and to tell them that I feel like that I had harmed them. And he said, leave it there. Well, I left there that night and with my list, and he told me he wanted me to make them all within 1 week. And I'm saying, you know, well, what if I do? You know, if I just leave it there, what if nothing happens? Well, I have a wife and four children, and I started with my wife and went through the four children and saved my 17-year-old daughter to last. The reason I did that is about after I'd been sober a year, I decided Amy needed my help in straightening her act up. And so for about 4 years, I've tried to change Amy. And Amy has the ability to be as stubborn and as headstrong as I am. And I've really bet my match with her. I give up temporarily, but then restart again. But when I got to her, she was up in her bedroom. And I went and I told her just what I had told you, that I need to make amends. And I felt like I had harmed her. And she asked me, Daddy, how have you harmed me? She was the only one that responded of the children and my wife. She said, Daddy, how have you harmed me? And I was able to tell her that, Amy, the way I think I've harmed you is the fact that I've tried to make you into a person that you are not supposed to be. I've tried to change you and to get you to do the things that I think is best for you. You know, like pass everything in school. and do some things this way. And I said, I want to make a commitment to you tonight that I want to try to accept you as you are. Now, I'd like to tell you that everything has been wonderful since. It has not. I keep trying, but I don't try as long and as hard anymore. We got into it the other day and about her car, and she went storming up the room. She has, the way she handles things, she has her stomping through the house act, you know, and it infuriates me. So She went to her room, and not before long she came down, and I think for the very first time ever she apologized to me, and she put her arms around me and she said, oh, Daddy, you know what you say. And I said, what do I say? You say that I'm just like you. So it's kind of hard sometimes to realize that your children exhibit a lot of the characteristics that you have. I went to my mother. Now, I'm nearly 50 years old, and my mother still doesn't think I'm going to turn out. I had been in the program a few months, and she called one night just as I came in from a meeting, and she said, how are you? I said, fine. She said, I've just come in from my AA meeting. She said, oh, are you still going to those? I said, yes, Mother, I am. She said, well, I'll probably have to go the rest of my life. She said, you know you won't have to do that. She said, if you just turn it all over to God, he'd take that obsession away from you. I said, Mother, I have turned it over to God, and he's told me to go to 7 AA meetings a week. I went to my mother and told her that I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I needed to make amends for her to her because I thought I'd harmed her. Her response was, Stanley, you're not an alcoholic. If you just turn this over to God and if you just get good, you know. I could not be an alcoholic because my father was an alcoholic, and she's never really dealt with that. And after that conversation, I was very sad. I'm capable today of having a relationship with my mother. But it's not the kind of relationship that we've always had. And she cannot understand that. I'm sad because I'd like to have one. I'd like to have one because I love her. But today this program has allowed me to become and to start becoming and to become a person that I was supposed to be. My mother still thinks I should be a missionary to Africa. I tell her I'm a missionary in AA, but it don't compute. After all, that's what Carrying the Message is all about, isn't it? But this program has allowed me to be the person I am today and to change. I always thought if I could just ever get my, people call them the ducks in line, if I could just ever get my turkeys in line, that I could finish my life out and everything would be wonderful, you know, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Well, I found out the excitement in life is when those turkeys scattered is getting them back in line, and mine stays scattered a good bit. I'm very glad to be here. I've been to 3 IDAA meetings in Texas, and this is my first one of the national caliber type things. And I have a lot of friends here, a lot of close companions, and people that I've come to know and love. And I'm very grateful for that because I've always been a loner and a person that felt like that hard work and determination could do anything, and that almost killed me. But through love and sharing and trust that you have given me, I've been able to experience that in my life. And I'd like to close with a verse of a gospel hymn that I feel like that sums up how I feel about what this program has done for me. And it's Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved and set me free. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, and now I see. Thank you.
We certainly did all enjoy that, and can't think of a better way to accomplish a complete discussion of making amends than what you did. Thank you very much. Now for step 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And my good friend, Dr. Gordon H. from Kentucky, please welcome Gordon.
Thank you, Conway. I am Gordon Hyde, and I have the disease of alcoholism. I, too, have a very difficult my gratitude for being here alive and being part of this entire program. And it truly is an honor to be asked by Conway to be part of it. It really has been one of my heroes, and both he and Charlotte, I can share with you, have become very dear friends. Coming to our institution and talking to our medical students, initiating a medical student day at our institution, and have been part of 2 of those great days that have become part of my life. I mentioned I have the disease of alcoholism because it's important, as Stan just mentioned, for me to remember I'm a sick guy. I'm not a bad guy, but I'm a sick guy, and I try to keep that always in mind, and the treatment is right here. Loud and simple, AA, and what it's all about. The 10th step, continued to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it, has become also a very important part of my life. I think our forefathers, in laying out this step, certainly recognized the need for long-term personal growth. That we may be at one state at one point and we continue to change, and thank God we do. But it has become an important part of my life on a daily basis to think about what, in my morning meditation, what is taking place today, ask God for help for those particular events, and then to ask God's forgiveness every night, because I have not had that perfect day yet. I try to focus in on those things and ask for forgiveness for the difficulties I've had that day and hopefully not repeat them the following day. However, I'm also a human being and I have a great deal of difficulty being honest. Now, it's not so much being honest with other people. It's being honest with myself. And I can change things to my way of thinking very, very easily. Now, how I got here very quickly is I was born into a very functional, not dysfunctional family in which there was no alcoholism. A very loving family, but I have two brothers and two sisters, one sister in AA and trying to get a brother here very desperately, or who needs our help desperately anyhow. But my grandfather was alcoholic, and I have six uncles on that side of the family, five alcoholic, three have already died of it, and the other two are in AA. Very strong on that side of the family and also on the other. I have the genetic predisposition. Did the usual things growing up in Michigan, went to the University of Michigan through undergraduate school, medical school, and residency, and taught on the faculty for a short period of time, and then went to Lexington, Kentucky in private practice. Spent 17 years in private practice before this disease brought me to my knees, and during that period of time, it had affected me in most every aspect of my life. However, my last bastion of self-respect was my work. And like all of us, I tried like living hell to live up to that idea that I'm a good doctor. I'm a vascular surgeon, and through the years, it gradually depleted, and the shakes didn't exactly help my ability to perform. But the disease had affected my family life, which was in total disarray. My interpersonal relationships had totally disintegrated, had very few friends left, and just what I did was work like the dickens all day and went home at night and drank. Not on call, but I was white-knuckling it all the time. Continuing to work very hard, checking those notes every morning to make sure that I hadn't forgotten a nursing's order that I'd given a nurse or something during the night. Always with that peculiar feeling of impending doom that something was, the boogeyman was about to get me. And inner anxiety, those terrible night sweats, and tremendous loss of self-esteem. Doing crazy things that today I understand were part of my disease. Spent a night in a local jail with a drunk driving charge, but had no other real problems with the law. And physically, I had had seven hospitalizations in a period of 8 years. None alcohol problems, at least that were thought of at that time. A broken back, playing on a trampoline with my son. Boy, I'm a good father. I didn't tell you that I was drunk at the time, playing on a kid's trampoline that no one over 100 pounds should have been on. Things such as that, tearing up a knee, a car wreck, a broken back, broken ribs, a bleeding ulcer in Atlanta, for which I was hospitalized, and never was the question of alcoholism raised. Severely hypertensive, by the way. So physically and mentally, spiritually, in all the aspects of my life, I was a wreck, but yet, damn it, I'm a good doctor, and I'm a good surgeon. Fortunately, all this came to, within a very three-week period of time, it all came to an end. And I started drinking in my office, drank once before I was going to the operating room. I couldn't face this. At that particular year, I was president of the Kentucky chapter of the American College of Surgeons. I was trying to deal with people having these problems. And my loss of self-esteem had met its end. At that particular point, I was had the crying jags like so many of us know, and fortunately, by the grace of God, still had a family structure and a supportive wife who was starting to go to Al-Anon by that time. I ended up in Columbus, Ohio in a crazy house, and one of the miracles of my life happened that night that I was sicker than the dickens. As a matter of fact, I had pancreatitis that night. And who should appear but I'll break his anonymity because he's in the head, one of the great men of this group. And obviously had a very, very great effect upon my life. Over the next year and a half, I played with AA, having slips when I'd get out of town, but finally met my bottom and ended up in a treatment center at Lutheran in Chicago. Some great experiences happened then, and I've not found it necessary to take a drink since that time. Now, I've had an interesting, unique change in my career since that time, in that after this, a opportunity happened about 7 or 8 months later, and we're not supposed to make major changes in our life in that first year, and everybody was telling me that, but an opportunity came up in which I was offered the job as the head of the vascular surgery section at our medical school in Kentucky. And with a agreement that if I drink, I'm fired, I took that job. And it's been one of the... It started an evolution of just all this. First of all, my surrender and acceptance started the evolution of just tremendous changes in my life. That there's no way, even in my wildest drunken dreams, the things could have happened that have happened. And I'm so grateful to this program today. My family is just in... We've just got an incredibly functional family today. It's just beyond my wildest dreams. And the things that have happened in my work life, they also are incredible. And now I'm running our Department of Surgery at the University of Kentucky temporarily as the acting chairman, head of the vascular section and general surgery section. I've become a member of the Southern Vascular Society, the Southern Surgical Society, the Society of Vascular Surgery. I'm president of a national surgical organization and president of the college or the Kentucky Surgical Society this year. All things that in my wildest drunken dreams could not have happened. But where my real happiness comes from is working with alcoholics and working with the medical students in our institution and the residents. I love nothing more than taking some patient that we have who's at the very bottom of his alcoholism and sitting down and telling my story right in front of a bunch of medical students. I must admit there's not many of them I've gotten sober, but occasionally it happens and we get a few of them to AA. But it's been one of the great parts of the story of my life as I've continued to grow within this program. And that brings us back to this tenth step, which to me is extremely important that I do on a daily basis. I am one who believes that the 12 steps of AA is critical to our long-term and directly proportional to our long-term self-esteem. How we are doing and our level of serenity, peace, and inner strength are directly proportional to how we work the steps. I was very fortunate when I first got into AA to become involved in a step group. And we went over the step every night, and I continued with that for 4 years. That's about 16 times through the steps. I've gone back here and got a 5-year follow-up of 26 of the people that I know were involved in that program during that period of time. A 5-year follow-up of 26 people. Do you know how many of them are sober and well and healthy today? 25 of them. 25 of them. One of the dentists in the group is in treatment right now. But 25 out of 26, and it's also very interesting, and we think treatment is the big thing. Only 5 of us went to treatment in the sense of a treatment center. 21 of those 26 people, or 21 of the 25 that are well today just through working the steps of AA. And I hope we never forget that message, that that's where we are and what helps us become healthy and well. Through working those steps and working on this tenth step on a daily basis, in the morning and at night, I continue to have growing within my own self and my relationship with other people. I continue, however, to have difficulties with anger and resentment, particularly a couple of people in my own department that I have to, I get a knife in the back every time I turn around. I have to deal with that. I walk in my office and take say the Serenity Prayer, close the door, and sit down and think about it for a minute or two and go back to work. And I pray for the SOBs on a very frequent basis. Somehow it helps me get through the situation and survive the bureaucracy, which is the one thing in academia that I do not like. But I love being involved with the medical students, carrying our message to them, and we have instituted a very unique program in our institution in which now our medical students have to attend AA, and we get them a sponsor, and I've got about 30 solid recovering people in our community who become sponsors to the medical students. And they take them to meetings, as many as the students will go to, which is not many, but at least one or two. And then some of the students will continue that relationship with that AA sponsor. And if they get a patient with an alcohol problem, they'll call that sponsor and get them involved. And it's one of the greatest feelings I've ever had is to see some of those patients getting well in our institution, not because of their physician, not because of anything except that medical student working with his AA sponsor. It's really a neat, neat thing to watch. So that, in an essence, is where I am today. The 10th step in continuing to grow is just a personal thing, working on the anger, resentment, and particularly honesty. And I find that if I go to 3 meetings a week, I can titrate where I am and how positive I am, and avoid the negativity that we've heard discussed so much during this meeting. I'm absolutely convinced, as Roger was talking about this morning and as Burns talked about yesterday, we can control our own destiny with the help of our own God and a continuing relationship with continuing to take personal inventory and recognizing where our defects of character are that were recognized, at least that I read 4th and 5th step. And by the way, I went back after 4 years and took the 5th step again and identified other character defects that I was not aware of. And I would strongly recommend that to people who, as an uplift when you need a little rejuvenation within your own program. It's been a marvelous program, and continuing to work on it, continuing to grow, I think is very, very critical and important to utilize this 10th step as it's designed. And it can help us all. I love to really think about it's a proverb that's in the front of the book about living, our daily book about living a day at a time, that yesterday was but a dream, tomorrow's only a vision, but today well lived makes all the yesterday's dreams of happiness and all the tomorrow's visions of hope. So live well, therefore, today, and this 10th step is a great part of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gordy, and that's a wonderful example of a doer, of an action man, and one that really practices his program on a daily basis, and what all he has done for the medical students in that community and really for the whole South, I think, is very admirable. And thank you very much, Gordy, for being with us. Now, in choosing these people to talk about the steps, I used a prerogative because I was considering step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And I got to thinking, who do I know really lives, and that I know, on a daily basis with a regular program of prayer and meditation? And then it became very clear to me who I knew that had a daily program of prayer and meditation. And that is Charlotte. I would also add unto this, as in my introduction a while ago, as a grateful alcoholic, and I said, I'm grateful to be alive, and I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be here with you today. I'm also very grateful for God to give me this beautiful lady to walk with me along the road of happy destiny. Please welcome Charlotte H.
My name is Charlotte, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Conway. That was beautiful. And this is my favorite step. When I knew that Conway was going to be responsible for these last four steps, and he asked me if I would participate, I said to myself, please, God, make it be 11. Because 11, step 11, is, you know, I guess that at one point or another in my recovery, each one of the steps has been the most important step in my life. But at the point that I am in my recovery today, step 11 does more for my happiness, my peace of mind, my self-esteem, every quality in this world that I want for myself than anything else I could do. And I never would have believed that. I never would have believed that I would come to that point in my life. I started out as a Catholic. And to me, praying when I was growing up was something that you memorized, and it was something, you know, you went to Mass, and I always felt good about myself when I knew all the Latin words by memory. And yet I never got a thing out of it. I never got a thing. When Burns was talking yesterday about the guilt, and somebody else was talking about the heaviness of Catholicism, I related so much to that. And I don't know what it is about me and what it is about some of the rest of us that grow up as become alcoholics, but somehow we seem to hear a different message. I'm reminded of my best friend when I was 13, 14, 15, on up into my 20s. And this was a girl who was just like me. She was 6 months younger than I was. She sat next to me in school. We shared everything together. We shared our secret dreams and our hopes. We smoked our first, we had our first drink together. We used to swap boyfriends back and forth. We were as similar as two people could be, and yet we were as dissimilar, because she heard a message sitting in those classrooms that I didn't hear. She heard a message of hope and of comfort. I heard a message of guilt and of shame. And for many, many years, I lived that way in my life. She went on to a Catholic college, married a Catholic boy, had two beautiful children who are now going to a Catholic girls, the same Catholic girls' school that we both went to. And it was necessary for me to go to the depths of addiction, to go to the absolute opposite. I became the opposite of everything she became. I became the opposite of everything I ever wanted to be in my life. I drank socially, I say that very loosely, for about 20 years. Excuse me. I drank socially because I controlled my drinking right from the very beginning. I noticed at an early age that I drank differently from other people, that other people would drink one drink and put it down, and I always wanted more. But I watched it so carefully because I didn't want to humiliate myself. I didn't want to get embarrassed and get drunk, and I didn't want to have hangovers. So I controlled it. By the time I was in my mid-30s, I was married. I had two cars, had a successful real estate company, and a dog, a wide circle of friends, belonged to the country club, belonged to the tennis team, and I felt like a failure in life. I felt like there was something missing inside of me, and I didn't know what it was. I spent all of my time trying to run around and be like everybody else, and I was always different. There was always that thing about me that made me different. I never belonged anywhere. So I drank. And when my friends introduced me to marijuana, I tried that. When they introduced me to Quaaludes and to Speed and to amyl nitrate, I tried those too. When they introduced me to cocaine, I thought that I had found the first real friend I'd ever had in my entire life. Because for the first time in my life when I had cocaine, I felt like I belonged. I felt like I was a part of this universe. I felt like I was all of the things that I had wanted to be. I felt like I was capable and on top of it. And I was everything that I had ever wanted in life. And it took 3 years from that first day that I had cocaine. I became... I don't even have words to tell you what I became. I became the lowest of the low. I lied. I cheated. I stole. I did every horrible thing that you could possibly think of. I remember one day, I was living in Houston at the time, and I got up in the morning, and I looked at my face in the mirror that morning. I don't know what had happened the night before, but I had probably been up most of the night using cocaine, so I probably looked bad to begin with and felt terrible. But what I remember more than anything is looking into my eyes, and as I stood there saying to myself, I hate you, and crying, and watching the tears coming out of my eyes and streaming down my cheeks, and wondering how I ever got to be this way, and yet not connecting for one minute that anything wrong with me had anything to do with drugs or alcohol. Well, it was about 6 months after that before I totally hit my bottom. It's interesting that I began with alcohol, because I ended with alcohol, too. Through cocaine, I became totally dependent on alcohol, and for the last 3 months of my addiction, I never drew a sober breath. I'd get out of bed in the morning and wonder how I was going to get to the refrigerator where I kept my vodka. And every day, I'd wonder how I was going to get through that day. My body just about gave out. I got the flu and got pneumonia. And finally, when I couldn't eat anymore, and I couldn't sleep anymore, and I couldn't do anything anymore, I went to see my family doctor. And he identified my addiction that day and put me in the hospital. And it was there that I was given my life back. And it was there that I began to follow directions for the first time. Because for the first time, somebody told me what I had to do to get well. Somebody told me that if you just do these things, Charlotte, you're going to be all right. And I believed them. So I started to follow directions. One of the things that they said to me when I was in that hospital was that I had to work the steps, and I had to somehow find a God of my understanding. It seemed impossible to me at the time because I'd so long ago left behind that Catholicism. And I really didn't want any understanding of that God that sat up there on way, way up there and judged me and pointed his finger at me. I really didn't through all that again. It was too painful. And yet, lying in bed one night, I remember thinking, God, if you're there, just talk to me. Talk to me. Tell me what I have to do. Show me the way. I want to be happy. I want to get well. I want so much in my life, God, and there's nothing left. And I was suddenly aware of being filled with a great, bright light, and it was like this light was centered right around my heart, and I was just all filled up with this light. It was the most beautiful feeling I'd ever had. And after that, I had a sense that somehow it was going to be all right. And I began communicating with this God. It was my first attempt at prayer. It was my first attempt at meditation. But I began. I began taking little baby steps towards it. Also, this is one of the only steps that I took out of order, because I, too, was told to take them in order. But I thought, you know, there's no reason why I can't start seeking through prayer and meditation right now. So I started doing that right from the beginning. Early on, recovery, being aware that I wanted to be aware of God's presence in my life and yet not knowing how to be aware of it, I developed an idea of thinking of God as sitting on my shoulder. I remember sharing that with one of my older and wiser and more sober friends one day, and she encouraged me that that was a good step in the right direction and smiled and said, there's going to come a day when that's going to seem very simple to you, Charlotte. But it's a good start, and how right she is. Because from that day on, my whole concept of God has changed about as far as it can possibly change. But that was a beginning for me. I started getting down on my knees and asking God. I started turning within and asking for the things I needed. I'd get down and I'd put my head in my hands. and I'd turn within to that quiet spot. And I created a little garden of my own. And I could be in that garden. I could close my eyes. And I could see the peace. There was a little pond there and a waterfall. And there was a weeping willow and a swan. Because those were the things that gave me comfort and gave me peace in those early days. They still do, in fact. I still have the same secret garden that I go to inside at night. But I'd go into my little secret garden, and I'd start talking with my God. And I'd talk with my God about the things that had happened that day. And I began having conversations. And sometimes I'd wonder, you know, is this me talking to me? Is it God talking to me? And I didn't know, but it didn't matter, because I began to be comforted. And some of the things that he would say to me was that he loved me and that I was his child. That he'd always loved me through all of that garbage. That he'd never stopped. I'd just forgotten about him. He'd say to me that he was proud of me and that I was doing okay. And then just to keep going the way I was going, one step in front of the other, and it was going to be all right. And you know, those little conversations that I would have with my God at night began to get stronger and stronger. I went to a conference over Memorial Day weekend on St. Simon's Island when I was 9 months sober. And it was a magnificent weekend for me because, first of all, I met my husband, Conway. But secondly, I met my good friend, Dr. Bill McKenzie, who introduced me to guided meditations. And he calmed the whole group of people. There were maybe 200 women in a room. He relaxed us, starting with our toes and going up to the top of our heads. And I found myself totally floating. I'd never experienced anything like this. And then while I was in that totally relaxed state, he read to us the God Memorandum from The Greatest Miracle in the World. And if none of you have heard that, I encourage you to get that book and to read it. I have read it so many, many times. And every time I read it, it never fails to bring tears to my eyes. But that was the beginning of my journey of meditation. Meditation has become a regular part of my life now. I often go into a room by myself or with Conway. We often meditate together and put on a very quiet tape and get into a relaxed state and sit there and listen to our God. I've come to think of prayer as me talking to God, and as meditation, of God talking to me. I get so much out of meditation. I can't even begin to tell you. I get things that I don't have the capacity for, me by myself. It's not possible. And yet I gain a strength and a courage and a wisdom and a peace and a serenity from these times with my God that I never thought possible. I gain a sense of well-being, a sense of it being okay, a sense of power. It says in the step that we sought through prayer and meditation, asking only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And it's interesting to me how by giving up the power, by admitting our powerlessness over our addictions, we gain such tremendous power. By turning within in prayer and meditation to the God of our understanding, we gain power that is beyond all human comprehension. I have found things through prayer and meditation. I have achieved goals. I don't even know how to tell you what's come into my life as a result of it. As a result of turning within and asking God for the things that I don't have. Asking him for everything I need in my life. Asking him for the peace and the joy I've looked for. The peace and the joy I looked for in alcohol and drugs for so many, many years. And I never, never found. And there's one other thing. As I was reading over the 12 and 12 yesterday in preparation for this, one of the last sentences in there about step 11 said that one of the greatest gifts that we receive as a result of working this step is a sense of belonging. and how true that is. For so many, many years, I felt like I was standing on the outside of a big glass window, and I had my nose pressed up against it. And everybody else was on the other side, and you were doing your thing. You were going to work and being happy and having families and eating meals and sharing and playing games. You were living a life, and I was always on the outside. And through this program, and through my regular prayer and meditation, I feel like I belong to you today. I feel like not only do I belong to you, but I belong to this universe. And that's a good feeling. Because I don't have to be alone anymore. I don't have to be isolated anymore. I don't have to be different anymore. We are all really one. You know that? We're all one. We've got the same stuff. I look at you, and I can look at the divinity within you today. I don't have to look at. I don't have to look and try to figure out what you're going to do to me and how you're going to hurt me. I can look at the goodness within you today. And by looking at the goodness within you, I can look at the goodness within me. And that feels good. I want to thank you for letting me share with you. I love you all very much.
Thank you very much, Charlotte. I just wish to goodness somebody had told me to put my vodka in the refrigerator. As I said before, my name is Conway, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you. And it's now my opportunity for a few moments that we have left to discuss with you this 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. And first of all, I would just like to say I'm well qualified to be here. I started my training as a gynecologist. I did quite well. And went into the Army and came back from the Army. There was some drinking. I took my first drink when I was quite young. But I think probably the most significant fact in my childhood was the awareness somewhere along about the age 12 that I was different from other people, that I was different from you. I wasn't complete. I wasn't a whole person, and I never ever felt like I belonged. Something was missing in me. And through the next years of my life, I sought to try to find a place where I could be accepted and I could be part of. I finished medical school and did my training at the city hospital. I went into the Army. I came back from the Army, and I began to drink more and more. There's a question that during this period of time, in my early 30s, that I crossed that invisible but completely irreversible line into active alcoholism. And this was the horror part of alcoholism, with all the running and the hiding and the lying and the cheating and living in fear, and the telephone rings and panic sets in, and you don't want to go. You stay in your house and you hide in your office and all of these things, and you make rounds when nobody else is making rounds and hope that nobody will see you and all those kind of things. There were some very embarrassing incidents along the way, including I got advanced to the executive committee of the whole hospital. It was a large medical surgical hospital, and I went to my first executive committee meeting in that hospital, and I sat there. I got a little bit late, and everybody turned around and looked at me. I knew they were looking at me, and I passed out. That was my introduction to the executive committee of the hospital. I was hospitalized a total of 3 times, and finally, in the last hospitalization, I was in the depths of despair. I had destroyed everything in this world that anyone could possibly consider important, a home and a job and a family. I had been put out of the hospital, told never to come back, publicly humiliated and disgraced. I know what it is to be put in a straitjacket. I know what it is to be tied down to the bed. I know what it is to have hallucinations. I was in the DTs for 10 consecutive days at one time. I had alcoholic convulsions so bad. One night, the nurse didn't know what to do, and she called the doctor and said, "What can we do? We can't stop the convulsions." I was in status epilepticus, I guess. And the reply was, "Let him die. He's a hopeless alcoholic." And I was so glad. I don't know who it was the other night said that there is no such thing as a hopeless alcoholic. I believe it was Doug. Because I was a hopeless alcoholic. And I had received all that medical science had to offer at that time, traditionally. And I didn't know how to live. I didn't really know what was wrong with me, though. And that what's wrong was we are responsible for our recovery. But as it turned out, I wound up in a room in my house all alone, in the depths of despair and despondency, and my moment of truth came. And I was able to see myself as I really was. I was able to remove all this false ego, this arrogance, and this pride, and take this facade down and to see my naked soul, if you will. And with that, though, I knew then I did not know how to live. I didn't know how to live, but I didn't want to die. But the only solution, it seemed to me, was to die. And I was ready and prepared to kill myself. And my moment of truth came. And this enabled me to surrender. I fell on my knees and I said, "God, help me." A simple but a sincere cry for help. I remembered and had heard through my good friend Jerry McCracken here of a doctor down in Statesboro, Georgia. That's not very far from here. And his name was Dr. John Mooney. And I called him on the telephone. John answered himself. And he said, "Come on down." And I went down and I met John. And I lived there in his home with him for about 10 days. And of course, there was not only John. There were people there just like you. And you introduced me into the program of survival, but of happiness and of recovery. You put your arms around me, and you loved me. And you gave me everything that I have today. Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, while I was there at Dr. John's, on the last day that I was there, everybody had gone, and I was all alone. And I was standing there in his den, looking out through a pair of French doors into the November morning. It was November morning, November 1966, somewhere around there. And as I looked out, I became aware of the sunlight as it came through the little grove of pine trees and these shafts, these beams of light penetrated the panes, and maybe the panes magnified them. But as they came into my body, they were intensified, and there was a sudden surge of warmth. And accompanying this was the instant knowledge, the awareness. I knew that I was within the presence of God, and that as long as I remained so, I would never, ever have to take a drink or a drug again. I was free. My obsession, my compulsion, which had totally dominated my life since I was about 20 years old, was completely removed. Completely removed. Purely and simply a grace from God. My friends, I've never ever wanted or desired a drink or a drug of any kind from that moment. A spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, as it used to be. I don't know, I think some of us are, probably this is a very rare thing, to have such a dramatic, a burning bush or a parting of the waters in their lives. But the spiritual awakening, I think that as we refer to this as a result of working these steps, is a slow but a progressive process. In the 12 and 12, it refers to the 12th step as the joy of living as being the theme, and action is its key word. Action means for us to apply the principles in the way that we live in our lives. We work the steps. We live the steps. The 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not an intellectual happening. It is a physical process by which we are transformed from what we were to what we ought to be. It is a transformation from the negative to the positive. We try to carry this message to alcoholics, the second component of the 12th step. To carry the message, you must have the message. That's the second, very important to realize that it's a secondary part of the step. You must have the message first. Third, practice these principles in all of our affairs. The basic principles of life, the basic principles of living, the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic principle is the principle of love, the love of one human being for another human being. We've all heard all of our lives, it's more blessed to give than it is to receive. But when you're in the process of giving, and the depths of giving from your soul, who is really receiving? Well, that's the way we receive. The miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is when one individual who had been there is sharing his experience, his strength, and his hope with the poor individual, the sufferer, who happens to be there now. That's the miracle. That's the bridge of recovery. That's the bridge that leads us out of the depths of despair and degradation into the ultimate life of sublime living, the abundant life. I come that you not only may have life, but have it abundantly. This is the abundant life. We are the winners. We are the chosen ones. We are the message carriers. We are the bearers of the one great truth that God is love and love is God. That is our mission. This is our life. The 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a living program that not only promises but guarantees us happiness. Happiness is the bottom line. Not only to learn how to live, not to cope, not to hang in there, not to get by, not to make it, but to live and love and be happy. For today is all that we have, and it's the best day of our lives. Thank you. Let's all hold hands and close this again with the Lord's Prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.